Luke 8, all sorts of wonderful things to talk about here. Notice I've got the parable, start with the parable of the seed and the sower. I wanted to make note of the observation that's made here about teaching in parables. You always hear this kind of cliche, Jesus teaches in parables because it makes his teaching easier to understand. But then when you read, him introducing it, seeing they may not see and hearing they may not hear and they may not understand. And also, doesn't it sort of give it away that every time he says a parable, this disciples say things like, "Master, explain this parable to us." That doesn't exactly sound as though he's doing something to make something clear. Dr. Kaiser was showing me, this would have been a couple of years ago, this video. And basically what the video did was show, it was a science lesson, and it was made very, very easy, and there were all sorts of diagrams, and very simple, very straightforward. And then they test students how well they understood the concepts after watching the video. Then there was another video, and it's a little more challenging, it's a little harder, it's not as accessible, covering the same material, but not quite in the same way. And they test the students, and the students do better with a more challenging video than with the easier video. And what the educational pedagogy guy was explaining was, sometimes when things are pitched too easy, there's no, as it were, cognitive struggle, and so the thing just slips away, somewhat like rain on a roof. Whereas if there's some kind of cognitive struggle, you're having to, no, it's this, no, it's not that, where did that go? It's more likely to hold. So in fact, if our Lord really was throwing out things that everybody sort of just felt they got, in a way they wouldn't get it. He gives them things that demand, again, I'll use this phrase, a cognitive struggle, that you've got to think through what you're being told. And that very thinking through allows the teaching to kind of take a hold in a way that it wouldn't if it were just immediately able to be received. So notice you have these four conditions here. You have the seed that goes on the wayside, and there's no soil there at all, and it gets eaten by the birds of the air. You get the rocky ground. It perishes for lack of roots. You get the thorns. So it sprouts for a while, but then it gets choked. And then you finally get the good soil. You finally get something where it can yield 30 and 60 and 100 fold. And one of the things that Cornelius Alapide points out is notice that you've got things that are that among here, the wayside, the rocky, and the thorns, that it's progressively getting better. Like the wayside, it's almost like the seed really didn't almost have a chance, right? It just lands on nothing and the birds get it. The rocky ground, it perishes for lack of roots. So there was something there to sprout, but just not last. The thorns, you actually had things that were coming up, but they eventually got choked. And then finally, the good soil. And the way he describes it, the wayside, these are people who hear, but they don't even believe. It was given to them, but they just didn't receive it at all. The rocky ground, they believed, they heard, they accepted it, but they didn't persevere. They just didn't last. The thorns, these are people who to some degree persevered, but in a way it was fruitless. In other words, they had the faith and it lasted, but it didn't develop. The things that needed to develop out of faith didn't develop. And then finally, you get these people who really do land on good soil, and so they sprout. And one of the things behind the parable, the problem is not the seed. The problem is not what God is giving, preaching, manifesting to the human race. As the old comic strip in Pogo, we've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. The problem is us. Such is the human heart that a lot of times what God is dealing with is, right, the wayside, the rocky ground, the thorns. Notice each of these, as he explains, it stands for different things. The folks on the wayside, Satan takes, you know, the belief out of their hearts, or the ability to hear out of their hearts. We'll talk about this later when we talk about the section on the Gerasene demoniac. But remember, that isn't something that is happening without some kind of cooperation on the part of the person. In other words, you're not meant to think that somehow these folks are just victims. No, there's something in them that sets them up for it to be snatched that easily from them. You know, the rocky ground, right? That they don't really have any roots. They don't have any kind of seriousness or commitment, as he puts it. The thorns, the cares, the pleasures of the world are what end up choking them. So they develop for a while, but they aren't able to bypass those things. And then finally, these ones that are on good soil, there has to be a response on the part of the person to what it is that God is giving. There's God showering this love and mercy and salvation, and so if there isn't a response, that the problem is not God. Very often, you will hear this with miracles. If only God would work more miracles, if he would make himself better known, more people would respond. You know, part of this parable is understanding that's not the case. That really, you may look out on a world and you feel like God isn't making himself known or God isn't manifesting himself. And God is responding to you in this parable by telling you, no, I am. I am making myself known. What you are not understanding is the hardness of the human heart. You do not understand what I'm working with, or, to put it another way, what I'm working against. You do not understand what I'm working against. And it could be that if we were to have a really frank conversation with ourselves, you know, even within ourselves, you know, even wherever you're at in terms of living a faith life and living a spiritual life, you know, are there things where he really is trying to push you along further, get you deeper, really allow you to become holy? And there he is, raining all these reminders, and it's like you're like, look at my inbox, it's just full of this stuff. I'm gonna move this over to a file somewhere. We just don't respond. I put here stats for salvation. I think our initial impulse is just to think that, of course, like somehow most people are making it, or you know that there's all this love and mercy and generosity out there. When you read a parable like this, you know it really makes it sound like proportionally, the number of folks who are really collaborating or cooperating is kind of relatively small. And again, you could look at that and think, oh my gosh, this is just like Calvinism. This is God picks the elect. He's working with a few. It's like he doesn't care about anybody else. No, a loving, merciful, provident God is not necessarily going to get the kind of results that you and I might hope for. Again, because of the hardness of the human heart, there are just going to be all sorts of people that he's raining the seed down on, that either because of just willfulness or malice or the love of the world or the love of comfort or whatever it is, they just simply don't respond. They just don't respond. And again, it could be for ourselves. You know, we don't respond in the way that we should. You know, I know that I myself, I have to, you know, ask myself very seriously when I think about, you know, my I came into the church really at the prayers of my grandmother. I was able to go to a Catholic college where there was daily mass. You know, there was the opportunity for daily mass when I went to graduate school, even though there were a lot of wheels off things in where I went to graduate school. You know, there's just all sorts of things that have been there in my life. If I'm not living a saintly life, what exactly is my excuse? Well, you know, if I were to come before my Lord in judgment, he could quite honestly say, what more did I have to do for you? Was there something more I needed to provide for you? What more did you need exactly? So if I'm not living a saintly life, you know, that's firmly laid at my door. It's not like I could very honestly say, well, you didn't give me the chance for this or the chance for that or the chance for the next thing. In fact, after this parable, to him who has, right, to him who has much will be given, to him who has not, the little he has will be taken away. It's hard not to read that and feel as though, oh my gosh, that just sounds so mean. But as a, funny, this this just came up last night with a deacon candidate class I was teaching, and the context was this, that, well, is this kind of like a spiritual principle or a supernatural principle? You know, the sad thing is it's something you see around you all the time. As a teacher, this is one of my favorite lines as a teacher, where, let's say, in moral theology, we have tests that are coming up, and I will put out what I call essay minimums. You're going to write an essay. Here are the 3 points that you need to hit. And I especially put that out for kids who struggle with writing. Like, they got their notes, and they got their book, and they just don't know where to start. Okay, here's something to start with. Talk about this, talk about this, talk about this. But then, those kids who are on the lower performing end, they may not even look at it at all. Here's this thing that I have put out so that they will get starting writing. No, I can't write. Forget it. Whereas, right, you know, Little Miss Perfect, who's got her color-coded notebook. Oh, essay minimums. Oh, this can start my outline. She needs essay minimums, you know, like what? Like she needs me to write the essays for her. You know, those who have the disposition, the ability to self-discipline, you give them things and they just make a masterpiece of it. And the very people that you're trying to help, forget it, ignore it. It only happens if their parents order them really at gunpoint. And sometimes that doesn't even work. Just shoot me. I don't want to study. Life isn't worth it. Just end my life now. There are so many areas of life where the little that you're giving to people, those who have, they make the most of it. And those who have not, it's like they lose the little they have. So it's not just a spiritual principle or a theological principle. There's so many areas of human life that, and it galls you. You know, for me as a teacher, it's not like it annoys me. It's more like you look at these kids that struggle, and it's almost like your heart breaks for them. You know, you want to give them something that will allow them to get out of whatever little hole, whatever hole they've gotten themselves into, and they won't cooperate. there are things that you can do for a student if they're willing. But if they just decide, I'm not going to do it, there's not much you can do at that point. The miracle of the storm. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Dr. Crocker.
In evangelistic Christianity, we talk about gospel of prosperity. It attracts, you know,
Sure it does.
So, you know, tomorrow is given, more they get, but you know, so they preach that. I mean, and I'm confused by that. Can you say?
Well, it's a total abuse of scripture interpretation, you know, because in fact, what the apostles are told, you know, think about James and John, who want to be at the right hand or in the left hand, and they get a total bait and switch. You know, to put you at my right hand or my left isn't for me to give, but drinking of the chalice that I'm going to drink, yeah, that's what you're going to get. How does the prosperity gospel, how did it work out for the apostles exactly? Those guys all died with their boots on. They all died as martyrs, except for John, who miraculously survives being boiled in oil. It doesn't look like the initial recruits, you know, benefited from the prosperity gospel. By the way, when you listen to the canon of the Mass, you know, when you're listening, you know, Linus, Cletus, Sixtus, Clement, those early popes, I want to say the first 2 centuries, they all died as martyrs. Again, they didn't seem to get the benefit of the prosperity gospel. The foxes have their holes. The birds, birds have their lairs, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. None of that makes any sense. The prosperity gospel really depends on kind of skipping the New Testament and going back to an Old Testament version of I will be your God, you will be my people, you will dwell long in the land, it will be a land flowing with milk and honey, you will be spared from your enemies, you will receive the wealth of the nations. The Old Testament offered earthly goods and earthly promises because that's where those people were at that stage. But the New Testament, for the first time, you hear about heaven and hell and eternal life and union with God. So the spirituality of the prosperity gospel, yes, it's attractive, but it's just retrograde. You are going back. You are not going forward. And once you think about it concretely, pick up Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, where you have these people, Jews, Christians, unbelievers, who are thrown into a concentration camp. Are you really supposed to preach to these people about how it is that if they accept God, somehow their life is going to turn around, they're going to be showered with this cornucopia? Didn't seem to work out for Maximilian Kolbe. Right? 10 people are sent off to the hunger bunker, one of them, a married man, cries, right? He's hoping to survive Auschwitz. And what does Maximilian Kolbe do? I will take the place of that man. So the prosperity gospel, I have to say, is a kind of a con job. I mean, I hate to speak about it that harshly, but it's so contradictory to the message of the apostles that I think it ends up being a kind of a con job. And the people who promote it seem to do very well for themselves. They're not going to die with their boots on. They do very well for themselves indeed. How's that, Dr. Crocker?
Excellent.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to use that as an apologetic.
I've only seen Joel Osteen once. I happened to be at my gym on a Sunday morning, and it was on the televisions. There's a lot about the world that I learned from looking at the televisions in my gym, and I was almost in. It was the first time I had heard it, and I was almost in disbelief. But Joel Osteen packs, 40,000 people into a stadium. It's unbelievable, but it's phony. Some level, it's phony. It works out very well for Joel Osteen.
That would be the thorn, then, right?
The what? Yeah. Yep. Cares the pleasures of the world, the riches of the world. I thought I saw a hand over. No. Go ahead.
I was just going to add to it because God is generous. He's generous all that. And the more you give, the more you get in some, obviously it's the material problem is our attachment to it.
Yep.
That is what brings us down. So as long as you...
Yeah, the idea is not that wealth is bad,
right,
but the idea that somehow our devotion to God is paid in prosperity, that just flies in the face of church history. It flies in the face of the very lives that the apostles led.
Can I ask a question on that?
Please.
This is something that always trips me up with that, the thorns and the good soil. With the good soil, he says, the fruits are 100-fold.
Yep. Well, but 30, 60, and 100. So evidently, even when you talk about the way in which it's fruitful to different degrees. So there are people who, they even if we're talking about fruitfulness as lives of holiness, there are gradations of holiness. It could be that even if I live out my holiness to its full capacity, it still won't quite be the holiness of, let's say, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. Yeah. Even me firing off at the best of my ability is still not as holy as possibly other people out there. Because remember, God is not interested in equality. You live in a universe that's just riddled through with inequality all over the place. And I realize in social life we resent inequality, There you are in the kindergarten. And there's that girl, she's always going to be like class president. Always. She's like class president when she got into high school. And there was that boy who was just the jock. He was that way when he's 6, and now he's that way when he's 16. And there's that kid with the glasses who's like super smart. And he's always super smart. Now he's getting A's in calculus. There are just an unequal distribution of things. But the reason there's that unequal distribution is because that's what allows us to depend on each other. God does not want a kind of radical inequality, which then creates radical independence. Where you have that, you just have people who, sort of, as it were, look at each other, I don't need you. But the fact that we have differences in intelligence and beauty and social skills and all the rest of it, we all depend on each other. That's annoying. We want to just be independent and need for no one. But God wants a universe in which it depends. And the beautiful thing that C.S. Lewis will talk about in that essay on heaven, in The Problem of Pain. Again, those essays on heaven and hell and The Problem of Pain, two of the best things I think Lewis wrote theologically. But he'll talk about how it is that in heaven, you're not having everybody, as it were, have the same vision. You're talking about an infinite vision. So in a way, they're getting that vision in their own way. And the very thing that makes heaven a community is that you would be able to talk to each other about that vision and really be filling out what each of you are seeing. It's not like you're looking at the jumbotron of beatitude, like somehow it's at Target Field. And you're, yeah, seeing that triune God up there? Truth, beauty, goodness? Yeah, I am too. Yeah, that looks pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah. You're not all looking at the same thing. You are receiving a vision that each of you, in a way, are receiving kind of tailored to your personality, your history. And so, of course, you talk to St. Dominic, and you talk to St. Francis, and you talk to Catherine of Siena. You are getting your own personal vision filled out from what it is that they're receiving. Because you're receiving an infinite good. None of you are just going to be able to, as it were, comprehend the whole thing and have it. Let's see, I'll just say this briefly. Remember, the miracle of the storm, the rebuking of the storm, is again establishing that we're talking about a being with divine power. You know, this is another thing that establishes that Jesus is God. And it's followed closely afterwards by the Gerasene demoniac. We're not talking about someone, in other words, who heals, raises from the dead, has that kind of control over nature, but even the elements and even the spiritual. Okay, when you look at the traits of the Gerasene demoniac, Archbishop Fulton Sheen, I first heard this from him, that what the demon has done is kind of reducing his humanity so that he's naked, that he doesn't have that natural sense of shame, that he's living among the dead. He's not somebody, in other words, who has a social life. That when you ask him who he is, that he says he's legion, for we are many. In other words, he doesn't have a sense of self. So that you have a sense of shame, a social sense, a sense of self. Those are all part of being human. And if you were to think about, ultimately, why do devils possess? Why do they do that? You know, in a way, maybe one way to think about it is, we are made to the image and likeness of God. And the traits that you see with devils, it's almost like a kind of graffiti, like taking a picture and writing, you know, mustaches on it or little horns or crazy glasses on it. You're ridiculing the image. So when they take us over and you see these kind of traits, it's almost like this disfiguring. They can't attack God, but they can ridicule the image. They can attack the image. They can disfigure the image, and that's ultimately they want to bring the soul to hell. But you know, why do they have the soul have these kind of traits? I read an article which was referred to from the Catholic Encyclopedia. It's not a Catholic writer, and he's talking about mental illness versus possession. There can be this very glib sort of outlook that, well, of course, all these things that are being called possession are really just mental illness. But one of the things that this writer, who was a psychiatrist, he said, if you look at a lot of these things, yes, you could say that there are things that would overlap with, or maybe be the same as mental illness, self-harm, the shamelessness, and so on. But he said, one of the interesting things is so many of the possessed call out to Jesus as the Son of God, and they hail him as the Messiah. And this guy says that if you want to look for a common thing that sort of stands out as not just mental illness, it would be that. That they seem to have this sort of supernatural sense. Not everybody is calling out to Jesus as the Messiah or the Son of God, but these possessed people, that's almost the first thing out of their mouth whenever they see Jesus. That's a sign that you're talking about something that isn't just mental illness. Okay, in general, where you have somebody who's applying to the church for on the grounds of their being possessed, they will do a complete psychological evaluation to rule out mental illness. And quite frankly, most of the time, it is some form of mental illness. In some small number of cases, you have traits that are clearly not mental illness. Moving things around the room, you know, through the air, sudden changes in temperature, speaking languages that they never learned. And in this case, that there's some kind of identification, some kind of supernatural sense, again, that isn't just explainable by the symptoms of their illness. I put some books up there, and these are books that I've read that were kind of helpful on the topic. If you're familiar with The Exorcist is based on a real exorcism. And Thomas Allen is the one who writes about that exorcism, Possessed. In the book, it's a little girl. In reality, it was a little boy. It started in Iowa, and the exorcism finished on the campus of St. Louis University. Malachi Martin's Hostage to the Devil is 5 exorcisms written up that the author himself either performed or was involved with. It's rough reading. One of the things, though, that's good about it is it points out how the occult and New Age spirituality and things like that can be a kind of entryway. And finally, one that probably more people are familiar with, Gabriel Amorth. Gabriel Amorth was the exorcist for the city of Rome, for the Vatican. And so he writes about his experience as an exorcist, and I think he has a couple of books. The reason to read those books is not sensationalism or whatnot, but the reason to read them is to just be reminded of the reality of the devil. And it could be you just look at that and say, nope, I'm pretty sure there's a devil, I'll give this a pass. Yeah, that's fine. I think especially for folks out there that they just think that isn't this sort of old-fashioned or superstitious, or don't we just have a better understanding of the human psyche? And no, that evil is real, and spiritual evil is real, and that's one of the things I think particularly Gabriel Amorth's books have been helpful. Go ahead.
Also, if you read the writings of St. Don Bosco, too,
yep.
His trips into hell, they're pretty powerful.
Yep.
You get them online, and they're frightened.
Don Bosco, okay. So next, we have a session next week, and then it's the Wednesday after that is Thanksgiving. So we'll do Luke 9 next week, Thanksgiving break, come back for Luke 10. Thank you.